Our first speaker is Tom Kessler from Flatiron Institute.
Yeah, great. So thank you. Okay, so today we're switching gears. Up until now, we've been talking about all the science that we learn from direct detections of compact binaries. You know, we've talked about using them to do cosmology or test gravity or learn about dense matter or do astrophysics. And the implicit or explicit assumption here is because these were directly detected binaries, they probably live in the relatively nearby universe, at least for the present day detectors. Now we're switching gears and looking not at close by things, but at the most distant astrophysical objects that comprise an astrophysical background. Two things. This is not a review. This is like my own sort of random walk of opinions and like feelings about astrophysical stochastic searches today. So take everything as such. And then second, please like interrupt me with comments and questions and thoughts and ideas. Like, it would be wonderful if this is, you know, if we can discuss during this rather than just have me like talk at you for 45 minutes. So jump in at like any time. Just a roadmap. So to make sure we're all on the same page, I'll define what we mean by an astrophysical gravitational wave background. And then I'll sort of get into my first opinionated monologue about how we need to be careful on a meta level, how we talk about stochastic signals, okay? And how there's a lot of conflation that happens here. I'll talk about how we search for gravitational wave backgrounds, and I'll show some upper limits that we have today and compare those upper limits to where we expect theoretically an astrophysical background to sit. So I'll do another like focus group question here. We started off actually with surprising optimism, and I think we'll find that after this, that optimism will decrease. But my goal is to bring us back up and convince everyone that the non-detection of a stochastic background in the near future isn't actually a negative, that we can turn this around and use it as a really powerful or an increasingly powerful test. And then I have no idea if we'll get this far, but if we do get this far, I'll talk about, well, what happens if we get just extremely lucky and we see something unexpected today, or we wait long enough and we see something with next generation detectors, how we would make the next step and actually convince ourselves that an apparent stochastic signal is real, that it's from space and not from the Earth. Okay, so to set things up, this is like my version of the stellar graveyard, the LVK stellar graveyard plot. This is showing every confident compact binary detection made by the LVK. I've ordered them just in terms of the order in which they were detected. Okay, the y-axis here is the median redshift estimate for all of these binaries. Of course, there are vast uncertainties that I'm neglecting here, so keep that in mind. Colors are arbitrary. The size of each circle, though, is proportional to the mass of each object in the binary. And as we've seen before, the majority of our detections sort of sit at or below maybe redshift of 0.5 or 0.6, but there are a trickle of events to, you know, more distant locations in the universe. So there are a couple events whose like median posterior estimates place them at redshift 1 or beyond. But you know, we're not seeing anything significantly farther than that. The universe doesn't end at redshift 1, of course. And if you look to the more distant universe, there's a lot of really interesting astrophysical information out there. So we expect star formation to peak at around redshift of 2. And so if you had to guess, that's probably where you would put the peak in the stellar mass compact binary merger rate. Gravitational wave sources themselves may just fundamentally evolve as we look back to higher redshifts. So for instance, at higher redshifts, stars are becoming more metal poor. Metal poor stars have weaker winds, they retain more of their mass. And so you might see just systematic shifts in, say, the masses of the binary black hole population. And then if you look up far enough, you know, you might see just new populations themselves turn on. So at very high redshifts, you might see a new population of binaries due to, say, POP3 stellar remnants. Or if you're willing to gamble, you might even look for like primordial black hole binaries that turn on at very large redshift. And so I think we'll hear more about that later from Salvo. And so the point is, like, there's a lot of like awesome stuff out here that you want to be able to study. The problem, of course, is that we can't. Okay, any individual binary that sits out here is just vastly too far and hence too weak for us to individually detect.
Unless there would be 500, 600 or massive black holes.
That's true. The point was, unless there are like black holes of many hundreds of solar masses. Yeah, that's a very good exception. Yeah, if you're too heavy, of course, you get redshifted out of, if you're too heavy and too distant, you get redshifted out of the LIGO band, but yeah.
No, what I mean is that we would be sensitive now in O3 already to 300, 400 solar masses black holes.
Yeah.
But we don't see them.
That's
so
right.
Is this the sign that they are not there, or they are just, you know, at the edge, at the limit of detectability, and we are not confident enough?
That's
to
a
see
really
them.
Good question. And I don't quite know the answer to it, because although we're sensitive to them, those events also fall into a search bin where we have the most, you know, some of the worst sensitivity because of populations of things like glitches. And so I actually don't know the distance constraint on those. Maybe Reed does.
So the distance, the horizon distance, actually peaks at source frame mass of around 100, maybe like 120. And if you go higher than that, you, like Tom said, you redshift out of band. So you're only detecting the merger and ring down, and that's at such low frequencies that the seismic wall kills you. So you're actually like less sensitive to a 300. Like, you can't go as far back for that. Even though it's super loud, it's just out of your detector's band.
Well, related to these two comments, and so a little caveat is, if the black holes have high spins, so do we have any astrophysical arguments to try and say, well, very large mass black holes will tend to have low spins, or the opposite? Because if they tend to have high spins, they, some of that gets pushed back to higher frequency.
I'm not sure what the answer is. I think that anyone who tells you that there's a very firm prediction for massive black hole spins is probably making things up. Although, if you think massive black holes are formed hierarchically, you have a merger of binary black holes, you get a bigger black hole, those then merge, then you generically get large spins.
No, it's, yeah, absolutely. But yeah. I'm saying, if we think of first generations, everything is made up, but even that people are making stuff up, but of course doing the best job they can, a small black hole pushing most of its effective angular momentum when it's about to form to an outer envelope or whatever, well, there are time scales involved there. And so you could perhaps say, well, there would be a distribution, and even with reasonable assumptions, you could say which way the distribution is pushing you as you go to higher and lower mass.
Right, and spins help you. So if you turn up the spin of a compact binary, just so someone doesn't know, you prolong the in spiral, and you get just louder systems in general. And so higher spinning systems can be detected farther away, but that only pushes you a little bit. It's not gonna like vastly change this picture. Yeah.
Yeah, what I was going to say, what two things. One is that the effect, even if you put all of the spin along L, it's a few percent. It's not gonna be a matter of many. And so about the SNR, like the SNR would increase by a few, or decrease depending on which way you go, by a few percent.
Otherwise, non-spin object would be outside the bucket.
Yeah, but still, I don't think it's a dramatic effect to make a significant impact. And we tested this. We have a paper on this kind of thing. And the other thing about correlation is that, if I understood, Luis, your point, that masses and spins may be correlated. So these are kind of things that we, both inside LBK and outside, have been I've started to play with, including with Tom and myself. So we did look a correlation between spin and mass, even I think in the O3B catalog population paper, and as of now, there is no evidence one way or another. What we found in the paper that Tom led, of course, is that IFETIV and Q are anti-correlated. And in a paper that was led by my student Silvia, which is the archive Monday, we found that the chi-effective distribution in the population seems to be broadening with redshift. So in the past, it was easier to have, the universe was less boring, it was easier to have larger spins in magnitude than now.
If there's interest, do you want to put a slide on that?
Maybe for the discussion, I can dump it.
Yeah, there. That sounds great. So there are all these caveats, right? Like, we don't have a firm horizon, and so I've actually, you know, tried to draw this as fuzzy. But there are regions that we can access and regions that we clearly cannot access with the detectors that we have. The way we can cheat, though, is although if I ask about any single object out there, it's we just can't see it individually. If we're willing to sort of squint and take every object out here in unison, so consider the superposition of all of these objects, then we can hope to detect that superposition in the form of an astrophysical gravitational wave background. It's essentially this random, persistent gravitational wave static that if we listen hard enough or listen long enough, we can hope to try and detect and characterize. Okay. In gravitational wave astronomy, we use the word stochastic background or the word gravitational wave background to describe like a ton of different things. And I think it's important to be a little bit careful how we use language here. And so in general, right, if we're just talking generically about signals, we can break them down onto a couple of different axes. We can ask about signals that are quiet, signals that are loud. We can ask about signals that are non-overlapping, so distinct in time and frequency, or we can ask about signals that are strongly overlapping, maybe even to the point where there are multiple sources in any one time frequency pixel, okay? Now, if you're in the top right-hand corner of this plot, that's great. These are the loud, non-overlapping things that are directly detectable. So these are all the compact binaries that we've been talking about so far. The language issue that I just want, you know, this is my own, like, I don't know, rant, that I just want to be careful about is that we use the same word for every other quadrant in this plot, okay? But this is, you know, really hiding very different scenarios. So bottom right-hand corner, loud overlapping things, isn't really a case that we expect to see with 2G detectors, but this will be a very like important target for LISA, right? This is where the galactic white dwarf binaries live for LISA. You have like tens of thousands of white dwarfs that are actually swamping maybe LISA's instrumental sensitivity at low frequencies. And so another word that people use for this is confusion background. Now in LIGO or Virgo, when we say stochastic background, we're really talking about things that live here, okay? But even then, we're glossing over, I think, important differences. So there are different source populations that live in different quadrants here. So the population of binary black holes lives up here. There's one binary black hole merger, like on our past light cone, roughly once every 5 minutes. And so if you could just listen to the pristine gravitational wave sky, you would hear silence, and then a merger, and then silence for 5 more minutes, and then another merger, okay? In contrast, binary neutron stars live down here. There's about one binary neutron star every 60 seconds. Binary neutron stars are very long-lived sources, and so at any instant, there are like many tens or maybe 100 neutron stars radiating above 10 hertz. And so if you could listen to this, this would sound like a much more like stationary gravitational wave, like white noise, not white in a formal sense, but in a colloquial sense.
So this will also depend on the frequency at which you're tapping the gravitational wave.
You're anticipating a point that I'll make in just a minute. That's great. Just to visualize the same thing, this is a plot showing, again, this pristine gravitational wave sky, so with no instrumental noise, but if you could just see all the strain that's passing through the Earth, I think above 10 hertz or something. Red is the contribution from binary neutron stars, green is the contribution from binary black holes, and you see this effect that I'm talking about. In the inset, the red is just this like sort of monolithic static of all these sources overlapping, whereas the green is almost always zero until every once in a while you get a burst from a binary black hole merger. But just going back to this quadrant, or to this plot, just the issue is when we talk about stochastic backgrounds in general, I think there are two questions that are important to make sure that everyone is agreeing on in the conversation. Which quadrant are you living in here? And also, which detectors are you talking about? The decomposition of this of these quadrants is a detector-dependent statement. What's one detector's quiet sources is another detector's loud sources. And what is overlapping for, or what is maybe non-overlapping in one detector, given the lower noise or the frequency range, may be strongly overlapping in another, which I think was Suwudi's point. And so for us, you know, here we're going to be talking about these two quadrants with our present-day ground-based detectors. Yeah, okay. So the physical effect of a stochastic background of any sort, astrophysical or cosmological, is to introduce this very weak strain into our network of gravitational wave detectors, but strain that is correlated between detectors. And so that correlation is generally the thing that searches try and pick up on. You're trying to look for excess cross power between widely separated instruments. And so on a cartoon level, there are complications that I'm just blatantly ignoring here, but we might get back to this later. Say we have a gravitational wave detector. It gives us some strain signal S. Well, we're going to say that's the sum of some instrumental noise instantiation N and our strain due to the background that we're after. And the assumption here is that H is much less than N. Well, if I have two detectors, S1 and S2, I can cross-correlate them. I can Fourier transform, multiply, and time average. Well, the two instrumental noise terms are independent. They cancel. The instrumental noise terms are also hopefully independent of the gravitational wave sky. Those cross terms cancel, and you're left with a cross-correlation estimate that just measures the strain power, or the strain squared, from the gravitational wave sky. And so the takeaway here is that these cross-correlation searches are not measuring strain. Okay, a matched filter search measures strain, but cross-correlation searches are measuring a strain power or an energy flux from gravitational waves. This isn't the only way you could approach the problem. There are alternatives that are being explored right now. And these alternatives try and key in on additional features or additional properties of an astrophysical background. So there's an effort out of Monash that's called TBS, or the Bayesian search. And this keys in on the fact, I'll talk about this in a little bit, that we expect that the astrophysical background is dominated by compact binaries. And we have deterministic models for compact binaries. Okay, and so the goal here is to leverage that determinism and try and do better than just doing an excess power search. There's also an effort that's sort of spinning up today. It's an old idea, but it's being revived today, is to take advantage of the non-stationarity of the background that we saw, say, for binary black holes, where it's not a Gaussian background. It's like this popcorn-y background. And if you build this into your model from the start, you might get a factor of a few improvement in search sensitivity. So I'm not going to really talk about these. I just wanted to make people aware that they existed. Another important question to ask of any stochastic search, both the cross-correlation search and these, is, well, say I go away, I do my stochastic search, and I come to you with a detection. I say I've detected a stochastic background or an astrophysical background. The question that you should immediately ask is, okay, cool, but very physically speaking, which binaries in the universe or which astrophysical sources in the universe have I actually succeeded in detecting? Like, where is my information coming from? And so to illustrate what I mean, here we have the Earth. Let's zoom out and then consider the Earth in like the field of astrophysical gravitational wave sources. Some of these sources are close by and hence within our horizon of direct detection. But again, this question is, if I come to you with the detection of an astrophysical background, which of these other sources are actually dominating the signal? Like, where is my information coming from? And there are a couple of different possibilities. So a common intuition is that astrophysical gravitational wave background searches are really learning about just a little distance epsilon beyond our horizon for direct detection, which is fine, but not terribly exciting. You know, you're not really learning about a distinct source population. Unfortunately for us, cross-correlation searches for stochastic backgrounds actually are sort of uniformly sample sources at all distances, up to some complications. And so to see this, you can just sort of do a little like scaling experiment. So I can draw some differential shell around the Earth and ask about the cross-correlation signal or the gravitational wave energy flux from binaries that live in this shell, okay? Well, the total energy flux from binaries in this shell is something like the number of sources in the shell times the flux per source. The flux per source falls as R squared, the number of binaries in the shell grows as R squared. And so you're left with a signal contribution that is actually independent of the radius of this shell that I drew. So binaries in this shell contribute the same signal strength as binaries in a shell all the way out here. And so this is the statement that if we make a detection with a cross-correlation search, up to confounding factors like cosmological expansion, where we're learning something uniformly about sources at all distances, which is kind of cool. That's giving us access to a really distinct astrophysical population. This is really Olber's paradox, okay? But just in the gravitational wave sky instead of the electromagnetic sky. Are there any questions so far or comments? Yeah. That's a really good question. The question is, are we subtracting the foreground? So when we do this kind of search, are we subtracting everything that lives within the horizon? For the results that I'll show you in a minute, no, but you can. It makes about a 10% difference if you subtract sources within your foreground. That sort of decreases your overall cross-correlation signal, again, by about 10%. But this is actually a very persistent debate on search teams, is exactly what you should report. If you should report an overall measurement of a cross-correlation search, or a measurement of your cross-correlation search having subtracted out your above-threshold events. So again, very good question. Okay, I'll keep going. Now, in practice, we characterize stochastic signals, astrophysical or cosmological, not in terms of an energy flux, but in terms of an energy density. Okay, and so we'll talk about this energy density omega of F. This is the energy in gravitational waves per logarithmic frequency interval. And then to make this a nice dimensionless number, we'll divide by the closure density of the universe. And so we're reporting like bounds on the universe's content in gravitational waves today. So the LIGO-Virgo O3 searches for stochastic backgrounds are now public. And so, they've been public for a while, but I can show you what we found. And what we found is unfortunately not much. And so this plot on the left is showing our measurement of omega of F, the energy density of gravitational waves, as a function of frequency. This is a featureful plot, right? Like there's a lot going on here, but the key is that zero lies right in the middle of our measurement at all frequencies. And so we have detected no sign of a stochastic background of either astrophysical or cosmological origin. Having detected no signal, we can sort of place bounds or an upper limit on the strength of a possible signal. So we generally model stochastic backgrounds in LIGO and Virgo as just a power law. So our power law has some amplitude and some spectral index. And so we can place an upper limit of maybe 10 to the minus 8 or so. On the amplitude of any stochastic background that may be present in the LIGO-Virgo frequency band. Now, one important assumption behind these results is that the gravitational wave sky is isotropic. Okay, we're searching for an isotropic stochastic signal, and you don't have to do that. So there are searches that break that assumption and look for directionally dependent or anisotropic stochastic backgrounds. And so these two plots are showing upper limits now as a function of direction on the sky in a couple different bases. The left-hand plot is describing the sky in a spherical harmonic basis. The right-hand plot has broken down things into a Hielpix pixel basis. So different ways of describing the same thing, and you can see that many features are sort of reproduced between both maps. This is, again, something that I'm not going to talk more about. I just wanted folks to be aware that this exists. Okay, so we haven't detected any stochastic signal today, but let's try and interpret that non-detection now. Okay, if you want to interpret that detection astrophysically, say, we need a model for how to take some astrophysical source model or some astrophysical source and predict the stochastic background signal due to that source. Well, we're measuring an energy density today, and so our prediction is probably of the form, you know, the energy radiated per astrophysical source times the rate of sources, and then to get the energy density today, we'll just integrate over cosmic time. And that's what this equation is doing here. dE dF is the energy spectrum in gravitational waves radiated by a source averaged over our source population. Okay. Here, R of Z is the number of events per unit comoving volume, per unit time, just as a function of redshift. And then we have some terms that encode cosmology, and then we're integrating out over all redshifts. Fortunately or unfortunately for us, when you do this calculation, you almost always get a power law in the frequency band of ground-based detectors. So compact binaries are predicted to give you an F to the 2/3 power law. Something like isolated, rapidly rotating neutron stars that are radiating gravitational waves because they're deformed, Genner power laws, although the power law index depends on exactly what's driving the spin down of those neutron stars. And then if you're willing to wave your hands furiously and say that supernova are just white noise bursts, then you might get something like a linear relation in F. This is fortunate because it gives us a really, really easy signal model to look for. Like I showed on the previous slide, we generally can always just assume a power law form. This is unfortunate because it means there's not a lot of features for us to actually look for in the data, especially if we restrict to a particular source class, so we know the spectral index, then that essentially leaves us with an overall amplitude, which is fine, but ideally, you know, you would want additional spectral features to be able to measure and you know, interpret. Okay. Neutron stars and supernova will, at some level, contribute to an astrophysical gravitational wave background. Unfortunately, their expected contribution is many, many orders of magnitude below our experimental sensitivity today and in the future. And so it's expected that compact binaries are really dominating any astrophysical background that we might expect to see. And so let's check how those upper limits that I just showed you compare to our predictions for an astrophysical background due to compact binaries. Okay, so I'm going to show that prediction here. Now, for each of these source classes, binary black holes, neutron stars, and neutron star black holes, we have information. We have information from the direct detections that we make today. And so for each of these sources, I know something about the mass distributions of these objects. I know something about the local merger rates of these objects. And to compute a stochastic background, the last ingredient I need is some model for how that merger rate evolves as we look back in time. And so for our purposes here, I'm assuming that their merger rate follows a time-delayed star formation rate. For reference, these curves up here show effectively our present day exclusion curves given a non-detection of an astrophysical background in O3. You can already tell from where these are in the plot that it's going to be bad news. And indeed, this is sort of where predictions sit. So an order or two orders of magnitude below our present day sensitivity. These predictions are probabilistic, okay? And so each individual trace here is a draw from a probability distribution for where I think the stochastic background sits, but you should look at the overall extent of the traces to get a measure of uncertainty.
What defines such a large spread at the beginning?
Yeah, very good question. One just caveat is that there are different uncertainties and different systematic uncertainties in these estimates that I'm in some cases ignoring. So for binary black holes, we have a very good idea of their merger rate today and their mass distribution, but we also have a very good uncertainty. It's like we know our uncertainties on those things. And so the spread here includes uncertainties on the mass distribution, the local merger rate. It doesn't include systematic uncertainties on how that merger rate evolves back in time. So if I had a different model for that evolution, I could like buffet this around by maybe a factor of 3 or something. Now in contrast, we have 2 plus or minus 1 binary neutron stars and NSBHs.
So is this assuming 1 year detection or this curve, this solid black line or?
Yeah, this is effectively like a 1 sigma sensitivity curve for our O3 stochastic search with LIGO and Virgo. So okay. if I had a background that was touching this curve, like tangent to this curve, that would give me an SNR of an expected SNR of 1.
Okay. So
would you then
digital for your? Oh yeah, I'm so, like for folks online? Yeah, I'll use the maps. Okay, so I have like multiple screens going on. There we go. We're talking about this curve right here. So something that was touching this curve, like if I took this and boosted it to this level, that would give me an expected signal to noise ratio of 1, which is still very marginal. But you know, something that was a factor of 10 above this curve would give me a signal to noise ratio of 10. We are down here a factor of like 30 below the curve, and so we have a signal to noise ratio of 0.
Does it, Eric, how does this scale with the sensitivity of the detector? Is the square of the sensitivity of the detector? Or?
That's a really good question, and it's a little bit non-trivial. So first, you expect this curve to fall with the square root of the integration time. However, stochastic search sensitivities really, really depend on your low frequency detector sensitivity. And so in practice, we've seen much more rapid scaling of this curve moving down as low frequency sensitivity improves in detectors. And so often, like commissioning work that just moves the noise floor at low frequencies is vastly better than just sitting and integrating for more time. So it's a combination of these two effects.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, so why do you have a turnaround at large frequencies?
Yeah, like right here?
Yeah?
Yeah, very good question. So this is where binaries in the local universe are merging.
Oh, okay. It's
yeah, no, this is great. I should have mentioned this. So essentially binaries in the local universe are just merging here. And so you get a turnover just because at large frequencies, there are no binary black holes radiating. Now, out here, this is that F to the 2/3 power law that I talked about.
Right.
And this is a contribution of binaries in the local universe at earlier stages of their in-spiral. And hence they're at like lower frequencies, or binaries in the more distant universe that are merging out here because they're redshifted.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, but this is a good illustration of that statement that for our search purposes, we can largely treat these as F to the 2/3 power laws. Okay, circling back to, your question. We know we have good measurements and uncertainties on the BBH mass distribution. We have two plus or minus one BNSs and NSBHs, so we can't really say anything systematic about their mass distribution. And so for these latter two categories, I've just picked a mass distribution. And so the uncertainties here are really just the uncertainties in the merger rate, which are 100% with like two events. But that means there are additional systematic uncertainties over here on the right. There's the systematic uncertainty in how I've rewound the merger rate as a function of time, and systematic uncertainty on the mass distribution of these objects. So there may be an additional order of magnitude to play with here. Did that answer?
Yeah, cool. If you were to go on a limb and say, well, the tightness of BBH from astrophysical reasons,
yeah,
can I use that to transfer something onto the BNS and NSBH to tighten, would it go upward? Will you be picking up the upper end of that thing or the lower end of that thing?
Gotcha. I think it depends on what nature nature ends up deciding for the mass distribution of these. A cross-correlation search can't presently decompose these different contributions to an astrophysical background. All we get is the total, and so let's look at the total. Again, that's these dark blue traces here. I'll use the mouse for folks online. The solid black curve is again showing our present day experimental sensitivity, which is still an order of magnitude or a factor of 30 above where we expect things to sit. But we can ask what about the sensitivities of future detector networks. So after about 1 year of observation with design sensitivity, LIGO and Virgo, we might expect to just sort of be touching this region where we reasonably predict an astrophysical background to be. But I think it's not really until the design A plus configuration. So this is like post, maybe late 05 or post 05, I think, that we really strongly probe this predicted region for the astrophysical gravitational wave background. Yeah, Katarina.
I have a question again, the mass distribution actually. So which is better, let's say for neutron stars, so we don't have to care about merger, which is better, having heavy or light neutron stars? If they're heavy, the signal is stronger, but then you resolve more and you remove them from the background. Do you prefer heavy neutron stars or light neutron stars? Find the background easier.
I think that the benefit, this is a guess. My guess is that the benefit of heavier objects will outweigh the fact that you resolve more of them individually. And so I think we want things on the heavy side. So I know just anecdotally, if ever I want to like try and really pitch this optimistically, you know, you always choose a heavier mass distribution. But that's sort of a guess.
Sorry, yeah. A simple question. Omega scales like the amplitude square of the gravitational wave, right?
Yeah.
It's the energy. So it scales linearly with the time of data collecting, right?
Our signal-to-noise ratio squared scales linearly with t.
But signal-to-noise ratio squared in h or in omega?
Our signal-to-noise ratio scales linearly in omega.
Okay, yeah. So that curve scales with the square root of time.
That's right.
And so you assume 1 year time, 2 year time? I mean,
1 year.
1 year.
Yeah, on both of these curves, these projected curves assume 1 year of observation. Yeah. Okay. So my own, I don't know, thought is that I don't think we will detect an astrophysical background before A plus. Okay, this is my own sort of where I sit going forward. We should do a spot check. Are people feeling less optimistic than before? Who is still excited or who is still optimistic? Okay.
The excitement about the detection or the excitement of whatever, either way, you don't detect.
I think your excitement, it's however it's defined.
Okay, I understand.
Okay, so we had four people now. We had like 20 before. And so we've brought ourselves down. And so my goal in the last 15 minutes is to like bring us back up. So my argument now, or my pitch, is that the non-detection of an astrophysical background doesn't have to be a negative, that in fact we can turn this into a really fun test or a really fun constraint. And so the idea is that your astrophysical background is dominated by the high redshift universe, okay? And so if you haven't detected anything, well, then that's telling you about constraints that you can place on the high redshift universe. And so to me, this offers a really nice and particularly clean, like, litmus test on possible models or possible theories about what goes on at, you know, very distant locations. So to sort of illustrate what I mean, let's come back to this equation. This was the predicted stochastic energy density for some astrophysical source. And there are really, again, three pieces to this. There's the energy spectrum averaged across your population. And so this is telling you about, this is where you plug in information about your source properties. So this is where I plug in, say, the mass distribution of compact binaries. We have our merger rate as a function of redshift. And then we also have cosmology. And so if I want to come in and if I want to mess with either of these three things, I have to mess with them in a way that obeys the constraint that we haven't detected a stochastic gravitational wave background. And so I'll give some examples of this. My caveat is that these examples start really, really hyperbolic, okay? But then I'll sort of try and inch towards more and more realistic examples. So as a particularly hyperbolic example, let's just see what happens if we turn off cosmology. And so as our baseline, okay, here I've taken a reasonable model for the mass distribution and merger rate of binary black holes, and then also assumed Planck cosmology. So this is my prediction here. So this passes my test. The predicted background lies well below our search sensitivity. We shouldn't see it. Indeed, we haven't seen it, so we're good. Now let's see what happens if I take, so I have a merger rate, but now I'll describe that merger rate not as a function of redshift, but as a function of lookback time. I'll pick up this merger rate, carry it over, and drop it into a just totally Euclidean universe, okay? So if we lived in that Euclidean universe, this is what we would see. Okay, and now there's no cosmological redshifting to save us. Now the whole Olber's paradox is kicking in and we're just getting like blasted with this giant gravitational wave signal from binaries throughout the universe. And so we should see that, okay? We don't see that. And so we know that we don't live in this Euclidean universe, okay? This is again my like super hyperbolic example. Next will still be hyperbolic, but let's inch towards something realistic. So we messed with cosmology. Now let's mess with our source properties. So now the left-hand plot is showing just a really like zeroth order model for the mass distribution of binary black holes. So mass on the x-axis, and then a probability distribution on the y-axis. This isn't right, but it's not too wrong, given what we see in LIGO. So now let's say I have a model which is where I think that this mass distribution holds out until redshift 2, say, but at redshift 2 there's some transition and my mass function becomes like vast, like it switches to become much heavier. Now this is the overall background that I see on the right. So the two dotted curves, the blue and red dotted curves, are showing you the stochastic contributions from binaries below redshift 2 and above redshift 2. And then the red curve is the total. And this actually maybe isn't the best example to make my point because this just beats our present day exclusion limits. So this is still technically allowed, but in 04, I think with a couple of months of 04, we will rule this out. So this actually gets a question mark. But as another example, Let's play with the third piece of that equation for omega of f, which is the merger rate of compact binaries. And so again, on my left, I'm showing our fiducial model. This is a merger rate as a function of redshift that just follows star formation. It just traces star formation exactly. And now let's say I think that some distinct source, oh, yeah.
Actually, a question on the mass distribution you had in the previous slide is, yeah, we know that there are features in the mass distribution. I mean, what sort of sensitivity do we need to start resolving this in the stochastic background?
The issue is, well, okay, there are two issues. So first, you would need the features to evolve differently as a function of redshift. Otherwise, they all just still pile onto that f to the 2/3 power law, and you can't really distinguish things in different ways. If they evolve differently with redshift, then you might be able to get bumpy features like this. And so that's the dream.
Maybe I'm going to add one more thing on that. So yeah, if you get some kind of bumpy structure at a high mass end, start making your low frequency end of gravitational wave slightly more amplitude high. You kind of make it more fluffier and fluffier. That's just saying that the combination of both will contribute to you.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so, right, okay, we're playing with the merger rate. So our baseline is a merger rate for binary black holes that follows star formation. But now I'll come in and say, let's theorize that that the merger rate spikes just beyond our horizon just beyond our detection horizon. So at redshift 2, I've just put in this big spike in the binary black hole merger rate. Well, that does this. Okay, that big spike means we have a vast number of sources at large redshift. That vast number of sources will give us an overwhelmingly loud stochastic signal. And so this is not allowed. This I find really interesting because I sort of chose this example arbitrarily, but after I chose it, I realized that it is of some relevance today. So there are some folks who argue that the majority of the black holes that we see with LIGO and Virgo are strongly lensed. That is, everything that we think is a solar mass binary, sorry, a 10 solar mass binary, everything that we think is a 30 solar mass binary living down here is actually a 10 solar mass binary out at redshift 3 that is strongly lensed. Well, in order, lensing probabilities are very low, strong lensing probabilities, and so in order to get the merger rate right, you need to assume, in order to get the rate of observations correct, you need to assume an intrinsic merger rate that looks almost exactly like this. And so I think my controversial, uncontroversial assertion that we can make now is that our binary black holes are not strongly lensed.
Tom, about the curve on the left. So I understand this is partially exaggerated or exaggerated, but in the Madau-Dickinson SFR, which should be a reasonably good tracer of merger rate, the ratio of peak to Z of now is, I think, order of 10, while in there you have order of thousands, hundreds of thousands or so. So
that's
like,
right.
Don't we already have better constraints on that rate just by us, assuming that this black hole must have come from something, and if that thing is stars, then it cannot be a factor of 10 to the 2.
Absolutely. If you have theoretical priors, which personally I do, other people might not, then your priors are very much against a situation like
right,
this.
Right. So if I can recast, while this is is interesting, it's good to know.
Yeah.
Is it actually providing a constraint which people will find useful, or is just a proof of principle that this can be done?
Yeah, basically the latter. Although the next example is the former. Okay, we have 5 minutes left, so I'll just run through this. So these were all sort of cartoonish examples. But now we can pivot to sort of Salvo's point and try and more methodically, a little bit less hyperbolically, look at what the non-detection of an astrophysical background can tell us astrophysically. And so here I'm going to keep focusing on the merger rate of binary black holes. And so what this plot is showing us is our constraints on the merger rate density on the y-axis as a function of redshift on the x-axis following O3. So this was with GWTC2. Again, these constraints are like probabilistic, and so every trace here is a draw from our posterior on what this rate evolution might look like. But you should, you know, squint and look at the spread in traces as indicative of our uncertainty on the merger rate as a function of redshift. And now what you see, unsurprisingly maybe, is that, well, most of our detections are in the nearby universe, and so we constrained the merger rate very well at low redshifts. But we know nothing at high redshifts. And so it isn't plausible, but it was experimentally possible that the merger rate grew by a factor of a million, say between redshifts 0 and 2. But in the same exact same way that we've been talking about, we can now bring in the fact that we haven't detected an astrophysical gravitational wave background. Many of these traces where your merger rate just balloons at high redshift should give you a gravitational wave background. The fact that you don't see it means you can kind of just draw, this is cartoonish, but you can just draw an exclusion line here. And so if you instead do the same inference problem, but with a joint model for that incorporates information about direct detections and information or upper limits from your stochastic search, you place a much, much improved constraint on the merger rate as a function of redshift. I should say that this is a paper that I did with like Maya and Daniel and Will. I think that's the author list, but with a very clever name that Reed came up with. So the argument is that, again, the coherent combination of information about both direct detections and a stochastic limit can help us a lot. Right now, we're in this interesting situation where direct detections and stochastic upper limits are jockeying for sort of dominance in this measurement. And so going from O3A to O3B improved our understanding of the slope here. And that improved understanding means that we now just miss the upper limit, the constraint imposed by a stochastic non-detection. But as we sit and observe longer, this constraint is going to move lower. It's like playing like an increasingly difficult game of like limbo or something. And so at design sensitivity, you expect again to be able to combine both of these sources of information and get more than you would with either alone. I'll just show this real fast and then I'll...
So just yeah. Quick questions on the other one. The tightening for high redshifts comes solely from the direct detections? There is no muscle coming in from the stochastic?
That's right. So essentially what's happened is that we've learned a little bit more about the local merger rate, but what we've really learned from the direct detections is the slope. And so you now just like are shooting more horizontally.
Hey, Tom, do you have an idea of how strongly that constraint depends on the relatively simple redshift evolution model that we have?
It probably depends. Okay. Yeah, so we've parametrized this in a particular way that, say, could not produce the spikes that we showed, like a spike at redshift 2 that we showed. So we're assuming a relatively strong parametrized form for a merger rate that rises, peaks, and then falls. So that's the sort of range of possibility that we can accommodate here. And that's inspired by Salvo's point that we have astrophysical priors, that the merger rate of compact binaries likely follows star formation, or at least has the same sort of phenomenological structure.
Yeah, so this plot is very carefully made up to a shift of 2, exactly. If you have some other population at high redshift that is not constrained, so yeah. Some people make a plot showing up to a shift of 8 or 10, that's not correct. So this is pretty much the constraint only from star formation rate, assuming a MD form or something like
that. That's right, yeah. But just to give you a sense of like where things sit at design sensitivity, okay? Here, this is again from the same paper with Maya. And here what we've done is we've simulated a population of 500 binary black hole detections and a year's worth of stochastic data at design sensitivity. And again, we're going to try and play this game of inferring the merger rate as a function of redshift. Now, if we just used the direct detections alone, oh, I should say the dotted line is what I injected. That's what I'm assuming to generate my population. If we just relied on the direct detections alone, we get the merger rate right at low redshifts. But then at high redshifts, again, unsurprisingly, you don't really detect anything. And so you revert to your prior. This is all prior dominated out here. But now if you coherently incorporate the fact that we haven't detected a gravitational wave background in this simulation, you snap onto the right answer. And so this is really exciting to me because we're no longer in the game of, well, the incorporation of this stochastic information is now giving you actual measurements of things like where the peak in the binary black hole merger rate occurs. Again, this is model dependent. We could have different results with different models. But this leaves me feeling actually fairly optimistic that even if we continue to not detect an astrophysical background, we can use that as an increasingly powerful source of information.
Sorry, Tom, that is pretty neat. But just to understand the process to get this, so this correction due to the non-detection stochastic is built in the choice of priors, or is anything else? No.
Okay. No, yeah, so this is like, you have a joint likelihood, for your model, which, you know, half of it is from direct detections and half of it just uses your stochastic data. And so this is a posterior, not just a not a carefully modified prior. Yeah. And so my question for people to think about is, you know, I think this is where we can be really creative, is I've shown some examples and I've hopefully opened the door for just like people's imaginations, or I've tried to choose sufficiently wacky examples that people won't feel embarrassed by their own examples. And so my question is for you, you know, now we're in a discussion session or just, you know, on the plane back, is just to think about in the same kind of vein, what other models or theories or ideas can we rule out or constrain or maybe even confirm with the continued non-detection of an astrophysical background? I think we're like 5 minutes past the hour, so we're definitely not gonna talk through the next thing, which is how do you convince yourself that a possible detection is real? But if there's interest in that later on, we can come back and talk about that. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. So any question from the online audience? Yeah, please. Yeah. Oh, okay. If not, any questions from people in the room?
I have a question, maybe.
Oh, Rafael has a question.
Yeah. These are just two very simple questions. The first one was when you showed the LIGO constraints, you showed a limit also on alpha. I'm assuming that's just the prior that you were showing us on the...
That's exactly right, yeah. We basically reproduce the prior on
alpha. Because if you have no detection, I guess.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
And the second quick question I had was when you, in your example where you said you're turning off gravity and you're imagining living in a Euclidean universe, I was wondering why you didn't then actually see Olber's paradox and something seemed to have cut it off. What did you make, what was the assumption that cut off your signal?
Sorry, can you repeat the question? I'm just not sure I understood.
In your, I don't remember what slide it was, but you had the example where you said you're imagining turning off cosmology and living in a Euclidean universe.
Yeah.
And in that case, wouldn't you expect to see literally Olber's paradox? What cut off the amplitude for you? Wouldn't you get infinity?
Yeah, very good question. So here I preserved a merger rate that grew and then, you know, peaked like, you know, several billion years ago and then vanished at t equals, you know, 13 giga years. And so there the cutoff, what saved you from the Olber's paradox was just your merger rate evolution as a function of look back time. But, you know, if we had had,
Of course, there's no reason to expect an evolution if you're an Euclidean.
Exactly, right, if you have a Euclidean universe. Yeah, so that is an interest, I don't know. I go back and forth on thinking if this is obvious or exciting, but this is a very interesting statement. I think that from gravitational waves alone, you can rule out like a steady state universe, which people again might find obvious or interesting depending on who you are. But yeah, what saved you was the merger rate from just drowning in Olber's paradox.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, question from people, you know.
Hi, thanks for the talk. You might have mentioned this, but you were trying to constrain the merger rate as a function of redshift. Yeah. So did that like draw any constraints on the delay time distribution of the black hole population merger rate?
That's a very, very good question. What figure do I want to look at to show this? Okay, do we have chalk? Can folks online see if I draw on the board?
Yes.
Cool. Yeah, so what we did, so this is redshift, and then this is merger rate as a function of redshift. I'm basically pitching a project that someone should do. What we did, the model that we used in, I'll just show the actual results. I don't know, say here, was a model that was purely phenomenologically parameterized. Okay, so we had some local merger rate, we had some peak, and then we had like power law indices, alpha and beta there, okay? Now, an alternative thing that you could do, which I think would be wonderful, is instead to say, well, I think binaries are born according to a metallicity weighted star formation rate. So say, this is the birth rate of binaries, which depends on your choices about the metallicity weight that the metallicity distribution that generates the compact binary population. Well then, your model for the binary merger rate, something like this, is now you've reparameterized it, not in terms of these phenomenological parameters, but in terms of your metallicity cutoff and a time delay, or maybe a time delay distribution. And so you could do this in the exact same way, but with this alternate parameterization, constrain these parameters. And I haven't done that, but that's the kind of project that like is begging for someone to do.
Sorry to interrupt. Tom, so we have done this, at least in the 3G scenario.
Yes, yeah.
Pretty much exactly as you describe it.
Yeah.
So you're partially spoiling my slides. No, but so if you care for more math, later I will have, I will go back to exactly how this would work.
Yeah.
Of course, that would be only for resolved sources in 3G. It doesn't know anything about the stochastic one.
That's right, yeah. No, you have, I think, two good papers, at least two about this, and yeah, 3G and... Yeah, and yet what I'm excited about, I think, today is doing the same thing with like the stochastic constraint.
So,
thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so I have a paper with previously last year or something, 2 years back, on exactly on this, showing that delay time cannot be constrained, unfortunately, until A plus, because you always push left of your at lower redshifts, and you may not detect it at all. So whatever you are saying, we have done it in the past. Couple of years back, maybe.
I think I'm slightly more optimistic about this. If you're willing to look at for very low metallicities,
mm-hmm.
then you have a merger rate. You don't get clear, I should say, your posteriors on these parameters, I've played with this a little bit, are not like unimodal, but you rather can make, you have exclusion regions.
Right.
You have non-trivial exclusion regions in the joint space of...
So you can exclude in some part parameters. Of the parameter space, but detection is difficult.
That's right, that's right.
That's totally what we got. Exactly,
exactly. Yeah, you're excluding.
Just because it pushes too much in the left, it is no more in the background, it can be an event.
Right,
because
that's right.
Delay time is too large, you can push beyond a shift of one.
Yeah.
You can get the very, really the low redshift, and you see them as an event and not as a background anymore.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, I agree that with 2G, you won't measure these, but I think you can constrain them in non-trivial ways, which is
from 3G cool. It's very interesting. You can do very interesting stuff.
Right.
Okay. So if there are no more questions, let's thank Tom again.
Thank you.